This is Bob Inyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278.
Warning, there's truth over head. It gets beyond all the headlines you read. Don't need lip service with a wink and a nod. You need a man on a mission from God. Well, not to worry.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Inyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. Welcome to another edition of Real Science Friday with my co-host, Fred Williams. Fred, welcome back to the studio.
Thanks, Bob. Great to be back.
We have a lot to talk about. You're the webmaster for the Creation Research Society. 700 degreed scientist, advanced degrees, right?
That's right. And they've been around since 1963. And we typically go through their journals, and we got a lot of neat articles to go through today.
Perhaps on today's show or next Friday's show, we'll talk about one of their early projects looking into amber and everything we could find in amber that the evolutionists really don't get too excited about, because supposedly amber's millions of years old, some tens of millions of years old, and you find everything just like you find today in your backyard, in the woods somewhere, in the forest.
Yeah, but yet they'll call it primitive and ancestral. They'll use all these evolutionary words to try to give the illusion that evolution occurred.
The illusion of evolution, when in reality, it's these creatures are like you find today in the woods, and even their behavior patterns are identical to today's behavior of insects. So we'll talk some about that, but I'd like to start with this past Sunday. We celebrated the resurrection of the Lord at our church. How about at your church?
We sure did.
You sure did, right? It's 2,000 years almost since Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And I threw in a little bit of creation science, Fred, in the sermon. I couldn't help myself. Well, because Jesus himself in the Bible talked about a seed being planted into the ground, and it comes up into this new life. And that's an analogy, a model of our death and resurrection and his resurrection. And it's not only a seed, but that was in John 12. Jesus talked about that, but also tadpoles becoming frogs. And the most fascinating is the caterpillar that becomes a butterfly.
Oh, what an amazing process.
Oh, man. So I thought, why don't we start out by talking about that a little bit? Because on one of our shows, or talking about Easter, Resurrection Sunday a couple years ago, I talk about how absurd this is to think that this process could evolve. And I mentioned that this caterpillar goes in this chrysalis. It's not a cocoon. He doesn't spin it. It's his skin, basically. And he seals himself in, and then he liquefies himself, and he comes out a new creature. And I was made fun of on theologyonline.com by some evolutionist saying that, well, that's ridiculous. They don't liquefy themselves. So I thought, could we talk about that whole idea? And then I have a couple quotes from the world's leading expert on the metamorphosis of the monarch butterfly. He's Dr. Lincoln Brower. He's been studying them for over 50 years.
Well, I find it funny, Bob, that an evolutionist would try to make fun of you about the metamorphosis of the butterfly, when isn't that pretty difficult to explain by the evolutionary paradigm? Does a butterfly decide that his life is just not worth living, or the caterpillar in his life? He's bored with his life as a caterpillar. Right. He's out. He's on the dirt a lot, and he just he's like, I want to see the world. So he decides. Somehow he communicates to his genes that he wants them to randomly mutate, to have mistakes in them. So over time, natural selection can come along and say, oh, here's your opportunity to see the world, and you're going to become a butterfly.
Right. And then to do that, first of all, you have to liquefy yourself, because you're going to recreate yourself into a brand new creature. And it is actually liquefied, quoting from Dr. Lincoln Brower, who has written so many scientific papers about monarch butterflies, Fred, that it takes 15 pages just to list their titles. Okay, this is the world's leading expert on monarch butterflies, and he says that once they go into their chrysalis, or it forms around them. Then enzymes, they release enzymes that digest all the caterpillar tissue so that the caterpillar is turned, it's converted into a rich culture medium. And then it turns out that maybe the evolutionists, you know, they like to think that evolution uses spare parts and it just recycles them. Maybe it would use its heart, right? Now the butterfly would have the caterpillar heart. No, the heart is liquefied. Well, it would use its muscles, right? No, they're liquefied. Well, it would use its nerves, its nervous system. No, it's all digested and it's liquefied. And then this, he calls it a rich fluid media.
Wow.
That's what it becomes. And then these embryonic stem cells start to grow wildly and they become the wings and the brand new heart and all the
muscles. Something totally new, a new heart, new wings.
So that paradigm, how would it work? The caterpillar, okay, so you're describing a caterpillar that's especially ambitious, right?
Yeah.
He's just tired of seeing the undersides of leaves.
And again, evolution teaches there's two main things to evolution. Random mutations, and that means mistakes in the DNA, mistakes. Plus natural selection. So we have to try to figure out, we have to put on our, for a moment, assume we're evolutionists and put on our evolution cap, and figure out how can random mutation and a natural blind selection process do all this.
So, okay, so you have a caterpillar who is ambitious. He wants to see the world. So he needs to figure out a way by tiny steps. You said the two things of evolution. A third is tiny steps happen so slowly you can't even see it.
That's right.
So slowly. Tiny steps. Each step doesn't seem to really do anything. But when you add a million of them together, you've got some new functionality.
Yeah, well, so how on these tiny steps, what's advantageous for natural selection to choose from?
So the first step would be that the caterpillar is going to have to digest himself.
Yeah, so step one is to become liquid.
To become a liquid. Okay, and so that evolutionist on TOL who made fun of me for saying the caterpillar liquefied himself, I'll just call an expert witness to the stand, Dr. Lincoln Brower, who's been writing about these things for 50 years, and he says exactly that. Literally, the chrysalis is literally a bag of rich fluid, and then everything is rebuilt. And he goes through the muscles, the entire digestive system. Imagine you're going to digest yourself, and you're going to end up with a new digestive system. Even the heart, even the nervous system is totally rebuilt. And he describes it, and he keeps using the word miracle, that it looks like a miracle. And it does look like a miracle. And so it shows the brilliance of our God to do this. Wow.
Oh, absolutely.
But the caterpillar, it has been built with this instinct that if it goes into this chrysalis, if it's skin, it molts its skin, and its outer shell then becomes a bag, a waterproof bag, and it's going to hang around for about 2 weeks almost. So it could easily be eaten. So it climbs up into a tree, hangs on the underside of a leaf or a stem. Well, it weaves this silk patch, and then it puts its back feet in the silk patch because they have hooks on them. So it hangs there. And then it's inside this pouch, and it has to be inside because if you liquefy yourself and you're not protected, you're just going to evaporate. And that's pretty much the end of you and your all future legacy and your descendants. It's over.
Well, usually the evolution is from goo to zoo to you. This would be from goo to goo.
Goo to goo. Yeah, I mean, if you evaporate, it's over.
It's pretty much over
at that point. So it has to get a pouch around itself, and it has to release these enzymes in such extraordinary numbers that it will fully digest itself. So let's say that's the first part. And then, of course, reassembling yourself into a beautiful winged creature that can soar through the heavens, that's the next phase. That's the building phase. This is the tearing down phase. So we need to perfect the tearing down phase so that you digest and liquefy yourself in a pouch so you don't evaporate, hidden on the underside of a leaf so you're not eaten by predators. And so, I mean, none of that fits in the evolutionary model that these things happen in tiny steps. And they're selected, naturally selected, because they increase the chances of survival.
Yeah, this just cries for design. Obviously, there needs to be a blueprint. There needs to be information in the genome to do this tearing down process and then rebuilding process. There has to be a blueprint. Evolution can never explain the origin of any kind of blueprint. It can't explain new information.
No, right.
And, you exactly. know, Bob,
new
it's
information
the,
by random chance, it doesn't
exactly.
work.
Exactly. I mean, this whole process, it's so silly to think that natural selection and mistakes in the DNA could lead to all this. So what an enormous barrier for or problem for evolutionists to explain, and yet they'll nitpick you on one little thing that it turns out they're wrong on anyways. It's kind of like a red herring. Right. They want to take the subject off the fact that how does evolution explain, how does natural selection come about by getting a caterpillar to turn into a monarch butterfly? So right there, right out of the gate, you've got a huge problem that there's no way they can explain. But what's really neat is once you get to the monarch butterfly, you've got an incredibly complex creature, something that can migrate thousands of miles, and often they find they go to the same tree. Right. They've got these butterflies they track from Nova Scotia, Canada, and they go to the same tree somewhere in South America.
God,
it's amazing.
Is awesome.
And then another thing, Bob, that's really neat about monarch butterflies is when you look at them, they've got kind of an iridescent color to them, like say the blue monarch butterfly. So that when you, if I've got one in a display case, and it's really neat, as you turn to the display case, it's a different shade of blue depending on what angle you look at it. Well, as it turns out, the monarch butterfly really isn't blue; it's brown. But what happens is God created within the wings of the butterflies a very intricate design so that when light hits these tunnel-shaped things that are inside the butterfly wings,
right,
or things look like Christmas trees when you look at it at a microscopic level. They look like all these Christmas trees attached to each other. And when light goes into those crevices of the wing, they bend. And what scientists have found that it produces almost 100% light interference. So that iridescent quality you see to butterflies is not really, it's due to light interference coming back to your eyes. You're not really seeing blue in the sense of...
Right. And so it's because different colors have different length waves, light waves. And when you get these fine structures, the light gets in there and it's a bit freaked out of how to reflect back.
Yeah.
And that interference does these awesome things with colors. And our scientists are easily able to replicate that, right?
Yeah. Right. They're actually trying to. I've got an article from scientists working for the government to trying to figure out how to come up with a better camouflage system. And they're looking at the monarch butterfly design and how it creates this great interference of light. So, Bob, when you squish up a butterfly, which I'm not recommending that to our audience, but to those teenage 12-year-old boys out there with their little magnifying glass and ants and butterflies.
Right.
But if you look at the backside of their wing or you crumble them up, the color is a brownish color. So, again, the actual...
The color comes from the structure.
Yeah. So the blue that we're seeing, again, is due to the light interference. That's not the original color of the wing. It's
okay.
Incredible design.
So you have this species of butterfly or any number of species of butterflies, and they're going to go through this metamorphosis. Well, start with the caterpillar, and they have to either get into a cocoon or get into a chrysalis and then liquefy themselves. And so natural selection is going to choose one bug over another because it starts to dissolve itself. Okay, it starts to dissolve itself, and we're going to choose you because why? Because you're a puddle of – you're dead. It's not going to be selected. It's just – I mean, if you happen to have a mutation in your body that starts to liquefy you, that's pretty much it. It's over. And to get through that whole process to where you now are able to form this, you know, like a hermetically sealed cocoon around you, but it's waterproof, and then you're going to start to reassemble into a completely different creature, but that has to happen mistake by mistake by mistake, what, 10 million mistakes to get out of the bag of liquid to a butterfly? 10 million? There's got to be 10 million design elements in a monarch butterfly.
If you try to do mathematics on this, it would be completely impossible for this to happen by chance. And really, on this example, evolutionists can't appeal to natural selection, as we've made clear. They would have to appeal purely to chance alone, and there's just no way this can happen.
No,
it's silly. It requires a lot of faith. There's something in Alice in Wonderland. The Red Queen says that I think I can believe 5 impossible things before breakfast.
Right.
I think evolutionists can believe millions of things before breakfast that are impossible.
Impossible things before breakfast, which is very good today, by the way, Fred. Thank you. Just impossible. And you know what else? Natural selection, they think that phrase solves their problem, but nature cannot select something that doesn't exist. So for this new ability to be selected, it has to exist. Natural selection is a conservative process. It's not a creative process.
That's exactly right.
To create the new protein or the new function, that has to come about by accident. So that's where mathematics comes in, and probabilities, and taking proteins in the billions of possible ways a protein could be folded, just folded, never mind the raw materials in what order, but then the billions, trillions of ways a single protein could be folded, and if it's folded incorrectly, it doesn't work. So it has to fold in the right way. And then if it just happens to confer by accident some benefit, that'll be selected if it's not eaten by a creature that's 10 times bigger.
Yeah, and then we know there's vast complexities of the whole folding process of proteins. I mean, there's a quality control system. If it's not folding correctly, the information in the genome says, oh, we got to discard this one and throw it out.
Right.
So
and as they're folding, they're like floating around through the cell. Millions of these machines are being built at every moment. And if one is being folded into a right shape for a machine to do its job and it's taking too long, well, they have to monitor the time of the assembly. Because if it's taking too long, that implies that there's something really wrong with this protein. And so they'll break it down and recycle the pieces. They put it in a trash can and they recycle it.
Sounds just like design to me.
It really does. And you're an engineer, software engineer.
Yeah, it's quality control.
And we're talking to Fred Williams, who's also the webmaster for the Creation Research Society. So quality control.
That's right. And you know, Bob, we should probably mention that creationists actually came up with the idea of natural selection. This isn't a new idea that evolutionists came up with. But as you said, it's a conservation mechanism. It prevents lethal mutations from wiping out a species. Mm-hmm. So in the case of the caterpillar, if this was simply a mistake in the DNA that led it to liquefy itself to water, it would just kind of eliminate that and the caterpillar would go on surviving, and because this particular caterpillar that had that mutation would be liquefied and, gone. But we know that there's programming in the DNA that lets it, metamorphosize from a, frankly, an ugly caterpillar to a beautiful butterfly. Of course, the caterpillar itself is, that's all subjective, but that's a wonderful design in itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fred, I challenge an evolutionist out there, an atheist, to think through this, because for me, I couldn't understand, let's say, penguins. With God creating the earth in the recent past, temperate, why would there be creatures who liked it freezing cold? And I couldn't understand the craters on the moon. The earth is created recently. Why does the moon look like it's been, have the tar beat out of it? And it doesn't even have any tar in it. So I studied and read and pondered literally for 25 years, the one topic, 30 years the other, before I found in the creationist literature answers, satisfying answers to how these things have happened. Okay, so I challenge an atheist. Think through this. We're not asking you to describe in detail how this evolved. Just a model. Just theoretically, how does a caterpillar, by mutation, end up forming a shell around itself, liquefying itself, and then rebuilding itself into a completely different creature. Just theoretically, just with mutation and natural selection.
And what'd they tell you?
No, what? I'm doing it right now.
Oh, you're asking now.
I'm challenging them. Spend
great
the next
challenge.
25 years of your life thinking through how small steps, mutations, natural selection can do that. Just the butterfly. Just the butterfly, and then we'll go to the next 1 million species. Because each species has within itself 1,000 examples of awesome complexity like that. Each species, the simplest cell, has things like we talked about, proteins and enzymes, wildly complex three-dimensional machines with billions of possible ways to form their amino acid chain and billions of ways then to fold them once you got the chain.
Yeah. So, Bob, how does this all tie back to Easter?
Easter, because God, who knows how to bring a caterpillar through metamorphosis to a butterfly, God is able to bring us from this life to the next life. We could trust him. And Jesus Christ came to not only show us the way, but to enable us to have eternal life, because he paid for the death that we deserve. Because he did not sin, but we have.
And what a great analogy. And it never occurred to me till you had mentioned it about the metamorphosis of the caterpillar to the butterfly, and that we'll go through a metamorphosis. We're not going to be the same when we go into the ground and come when we are resurrected.
Yeah, and Jesus touches on that, the biological analogies in John 12. But the Apostle Paul, too, in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, he makes fun of people who can't comprehend. And he said, don't you know that the body that's planted in the ground is not the same body that's raised up? And we're planted in corruption, we're raised up in incorruption and glory. And so you put an acorn and sit on your bookshelf, and it's either going to do nothing or decay. You put it in the ground and it starts to decay and it explodes into life and the most wild complexity of life, and it becomes a giant oak tree.
Isn't it neat that God gave us this example of the butterfly? There's so many cases in nature where God gives us these wonderful testimonies.
Both frogs and butterflies, they've both been born again. It's pretty neat.
Yep. In the Psalms it says, his wondrous works were made to be remembered.
Wow. Okay, so now, Fred, could we get to this Creation Research Society Quarterly? I'm hoping we could finish this issue and get into the next one, because the next one is out and it's fabulous, the Winter 2008. But I'm still in the Fall 2007 edition of the Creation Research Society Quarterly. And on page 88, there's a neat article by John Dowdy, and it's called Deep Wells, Deep Time. This is an issue that we keep coming back to, isn't it?
Yeah, it's basically about why do we find carbon-14 in, like diamonds and coal. Well, this extends that argument to natural gas wells that are very deep, like 2 to 3 miles deep.
Yeah, the wells that he extracted gas from are an average of 14,000 feet deep. So these are industrial wells, obviously, and you have PhD scientists, doctors going in and extracting samples, and then supposedly that these are like 20 million years old or so, or more. Or, you could just add zeros if you want. But they're millions of years old. And so John Dowdy points out in this article that research has been going on for decades now where carbon-14, which decays rapidly, that's why it's used to try to date things like Egyptian artifacts, because they're only a few thousand years old.
That's right. Something that was once alive that took in carbon. That's typically what they use carbon-14 dating for. And just so people understand, carbon-14 is radioactive, so it decays into something else. So over time, carbon-14 will change into nitrogen. Its half-life on a geologic scale is very quick. It's 5,700 years, roughly.
So if you have 1,000 atoms of carbon-14, then about
5,300, actually. About 5,300 years later, you'd have half of them.
Half of them decay.
Yeah.
And we don't know exactly why, which half decays, and why don't the other half decay. We don't quite know. But, okay.
But it acts as a good clock, because over time, if you've got half left, and if you assume at the beginning you had no nitrogen, then you could say if something has so many carbon atoms, you could say, okay, this thing is 2,500 years old or whatever, depending on the half-life. So here's the problem, Bob, is theoretically you shouldn't be able to find carbon-14 in anything older than, say, 50,000 years. Anything older than that, you'd be lucky to find a carbon atom. You can, but the theoretical maximum is 200,000 years.
And, Fred, when a scientist says this fossil is 30 million years old, they don't use carbon-14 dating to do that.
They don't.
They don't. No scientist in the world ever does that because they know after 50,000 years or so, there's no more carbon-14 that could be found. But every public school student in the country thinks that the way we know that fossils are millions of years old is by carbon-14. They think that.
Yeah, exactly.
And that shows the depravity of the science education in our public schools. Homeschool kids know the difference. The kids at really great Christian schools know the difference, but public school kids don't. They think carbon-14 proves it. Well, we have found carbon-14 in all the things that are supposed to be millions, tens of millions, even hundreds of millions of years old. Like, as listed in this article, diamonds. We find carbon-14 in coal, in carbon dioxide wells, in coal beds. We find it also in dinosaur fossils, in amber. I'd like to find it in soft tissue T-Rex matter, right? We've offered that money, a grant to do that. At MSU, Montana State University, we've offered them $20,000 to carbon-14 date their soft tissue T-Rex. And so now here they've done this again, yet again, to these deep wells. And the conclusion is that fossil gas has carbon-14. Therefore, the age of the gases is only thousands, not millions of years old.
That's right. We should not be finding any radiocarbon in these, in this gas or any of these substances if they're truly millions upon millions of years old.
I mean,
they've got in this article, he mentions one gas well that they theorize is 300 million years old. Mm-hmm. And this article also deals with any possible contamination from groundwater and things like that, and has removed that as a potential explanation. So evolutionists cannot explain carbon-14 because we find it everywhere. So
right, exactly. And so, Fred Williams, this was fun. Please join me next week if you can. And guess what's happening next Friday night? Judy Brown will be in Denver for a fundraiser for the personhood effort. That's so important. It's at Sinzetti's at I-25 and 104th. And you call Colorado Right to Life for registration. It's $100 a plate. And Saturday night down in Colorado Springs. So that's 303-753-9394. And Maranatha Christian Center is just a great school where the kids get taught accurate science, Fred.
That's right.
It's really neat. Maranatha Christian Center in Arvada. May God bless you all.
Hi, I'm Bob's brother, Brian. I moved my remodeling business, Fancy Schmancy Renovations, to Colorado. You can call me to improve the look and value of your home and support Bob Enyart Live at the same time. I have nearly 30 years' experience beautifying homes. So whether you're in the market for a new kitchen, a bathroom makeover, or maybe a new front door, you'll be pleased with the results and happy to know that all the proceeds will go directly toward keeping Bob on the air with the truth. Yes, I said, well, wait a second. That's 5% of the proceeds. That's not, I said 5% of the proceeds, Bob, not all. Anyhow, so call for a free estimate to see if we can help you with your next home improvement project. And don't forget to mention that you heard about us on Bob Enyart Live. Call us, Fancy Schmancy Renovations, at 720-641-7033. That's 720-641-7033.